This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
At Ritual, Mother's Day is kind of a big deal, and we're celebrating accordingly. Find your ritual. If mom needs a bit of stress relief, digestive support, or is looking to support glowy, smooth skin, do it today with 40% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/podcast. That's ritual.com/podcast for 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 148, The Orphic Mysteries. Last time, I covered a brief overview of the mythological character Orpheus, the greatest, most mythical bard and religious scholar to ever grace the ancient Greeks' understanding of their own history. He was somehow related to Apollo, and to the hinterland kingdoms surrounding early Macedon. He wandered the world, learning and teaching about the gods, fathering children, and making beautiful music. He traveled with the Argonauts and saved their skins more than once. And finally, he died, stricken by grief after his own weakness condemned his wife Eurydice to Hades. Today, we are going to talk a little bit about how this manifested in day-to-day Greek religion and the more cosmological side of mythology. Unlike most of the other mystery cults in antiquity, the Orphic Mysteries are not named for their location, like the Eleusinian Mysteries, or their central god, like the Hephaestians, Mithraics, or many others. Instead, the Orphic Mysteries, or Orphism, are a lot more like Christ in Christianity, referring to their supposed founder or at least the first teacher of their philosophy, the mythical bard cleric Orpheus, who I discussed last time. First, a couple of notes. My wife is currently approaching her PhD defense. Part of the reason this episode was delayed is because I spent a lot of time last week as her dissertation copy editor. Unfortunately, that means that things are even more sporadic than usual for the next few weeks here at Hopful Media HQ. More relevant to the episode, I bit off more than I could chew with this one, everybody. Including discovering some very interesting vocabulary that slightly upended my original hypothesis driving these religion episodes. You'll hear more about that two episodes from now, because explaining the Orphic Mysteries themselves, let alone their central mythological doctrine, turned out to be a much longer project than I had planned. So what was originally episode 148 has now been split in half. This episode will be all about Orphic history and theology. Episode 149 will be about the unique mythology of Orphism. And finally, episode 150 will be the tie-in with Zoroastrians. Once again, History of Persia has fallen into a box of oops all magi berries. In all honesty, a lot of this is just because Orphism is not an intuitive place to start discussing the theology of Greek religion. But it is the most directly relevant to the Iranian developments that I want to cover in episode 150, at least in my opinion. So, to facilitate all of that, I'm going to lay out the order of events for these next two episodes in advance. Some of this is just intrinsically confusing because it is still a mystery cult, but if something doesn't make sense, especially in the second half of this episode, let that curiosity simmer for a second, and I will try and address it in the next one. I begin with Orphism's history, its origins, relations to other philosophies and religious movements, and a bit of its eventual decline. Part 2 will be about their beliefs in so much as I can explain a simplified version of them here instead of writing my own dissertation on some very complex theology. Part 3, aka the next episode, will address the mythological justifications and stories around those beliefs, because I think that's the topic that most directly leads into the final episode of this religion series. So without further ado, the Orphics themselves believed that Orpheus and his teachings originated in the mysteries of Dionysus, the wine god. While he is probably best known as the god of wine, parties, and debauchery, Dionysian theology and myth are actually very complex and philosophical. You might notice from the mythology discussed in the last episode that this doesn't really line up with the traditional story of Orpheus himself, who is usually more closely associated with Apollo. However, based on their shared beliefs, the Orphics were probably correct in the sense that some of their core ideas did stem from the Dionysian cult. The oldest known examples of Orphic philosophy in poems date to the 6th century BC. To be fair, there's extremely little Greek writing of any sort before that point, and it is entirely possible that Orphism existed before that. However, there are two important things to note on the timeline. First, ancient graffiti started referring to a sect of people called Orphics in the 5th century, probably indicating that the movement solidified into an identity in the years around 500 BC. Second, and maybe most importantly, this all seems to have taken root after Hesiod's Theogony solidified a century earlier as the most popular story of creation in the Greek world, which makes sense in light of how differently the Orphics conceived of that story. They were outside the norm, or even counter to it, depending on how you want to interpret things. Orphism first developing in the 6th century also puts them neatly in line with their most important religious and philosophical influence, Pythagoras. Yes, the Triangle Man. While most people today probably know Pythagoras for the Pythagorean Theorem, and not much else, he was not only a mathematician. To be clear, he was a prolific early mathematician, but Pythagoras was also potentially the most important Greek philosopher and religious leader before Socrates. This is not an episode about Pythagorean religion and philosophy, and thank God for that, or I would probably end up being 3 hours long and trying to cram Pythagoras and the Orphics in here together. We know a lot more about Pythagorean beliefs than we do about the Orphics, so I'm only going to address what we know about Orphism. That said, the two were apparently similar enough that various different writers over time claimed that Pythagoras authored some of the Orphic hymns, that Pythagoras was an Orphic initiate, or even that the two religious movements were identical. What we can say is that although he was a real person, Pythagoras took on a mythology very similar to that of Orpheus over the centuries, and supposedly he too traveled all around the Greek world as far as Babylon and southern Egypt, learning philosophy, religion, and science as he went. Eventually, Pythagoras settled in Croton, a Greek city in southern Italy and set up a school and community to spread his beliefs. The Pythagorean movement took off in this region called Magna Graecia in Latin. Eventually, this became such an influential social and political bloc that non-Pythagoreans struck back. By the end of Pythagoras' life, they were already under attack, with arsonists targeting their meeting spaces, and beginning in 508 BCE, a wave of pogroms against the Pythagoreans swept across southern Italy. Over the course of the 5th century, most of the Pythagoreans fled from the Italian peninsula and Sicily to Greece proper. That is likely the period where they had the most influence on the Orphics, with Pythagoreans trying to re-establish themselves in a new land. They fell in with the mystery cults most similar to their previous faith, in our case, Orphism. By the Hellenistic Age, there are really two strains of thought that I think you can qualify as Orphic. The first, which I mentioned when discussing the Eleusinian Mysteries, were the Orphic influences on other religious practices, largely within the various mystery cults of the same era. Some, like the Mysteries of Osiris, which developed among the Greek emigrants to Egypt, were directly tied to Orphic and Dionysian theology. Others, like the cult of Eleusis itself, were influenced less directly, either through overlapping members or the adoption of Orphic poetry. And I think that's important to recognize. Individual Orphic beliefs about the afterlife or the nature of the universe seeped into other groups through cultural osmosis and spread from there, even if it wasn't strictly part of their favored religious doctrine. This is especially easy to do in a broad polytheistic culture like that of ancient Greece, but even in more monotheistic, creed-based religions, plenty of people believe things that aren't strictly in their doctrines. Second, and the one we are focused on today, are the Orphics who actually participated in Orphism as an organized religious movement. It's still antiquity, and it's a topic that covers almost 1,000 years, so there is variation within this label. However, these are the people whose beliefs and practices were consistently more or less what I am talking about today. That's a part two thing, though. For now, I did promise that we would talk about how it all came to an end. Orphism flourished in classical Greece and spread with the rest of Greek culture in the early Hellenistic period. However, even by the early 4th century, Orphism was starting to face stiff competition from the Socratic philosophers. These were the students of the famous Socrates, like Plato, their students like Aristotle, and many more in the subsequent generations. If you really peel back the layers and look, there are Orphic and Pythagorean ideas incorporated into Socratic schools of thought. But as early as Plato, these guys were more likely to mock the Orphics than outright join them. The Hellenistic era saw a wave of new philosophical schools and mystery cults pulling attention away, and Orphism seems to have declined for a while. Then, in the final centuries of the Roman Empire, there was a little bit of a renaissance. This is actually the period of the Orphic Argonautica I mentioned in the last episode, dated to the 4th century AD. It seems that the Orphics were one of the many cults that exploded in popularity during Rome's chaotic centuries. There's just one problem that some of you probably guessed as soon as I said 4th century AD. One of those cults ended up being just a little bit more popular than the rest, and catching the eyes of some of Roman nobility namely the family of Emperor Constantine the First. Of course, I am talking about Christianity. So yeah, Orphism held out to the bitter end, and ultimately it faded away or was stamped out in the tidal wave of Rome's Christianization. That said, I do think it's worth pointing out today that Orphism is the basis for a lot of the Hellenic pagan revival movement. I have a lot of mixed feelings about neo-paganism from an academic perspective, but in general and more socially, I at least think it's cool. Anyway, I'm starting to beat around the bush. On to part two. Knowing multiple languages can open new doors, whether that's making travel easier, creating new career opportunities, or just a desire to learn. Language learning is its own gate of all nations. Rosetta Stone makes it easier and more immersive than ever. They provide the leading language learning program for desktop and mobile to fully immerse you in your chosen language with a more natural and effective learning experience. I've mentioned this before, but the True Accent speech recognition tool is a very cool feature if you've gotten a little too used to the surprisingly limited set of sounds we use in English. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience and millions of users for the 25 languages they offer, including Spanish, French, Arabic, Persian, and many others. Their intuitive learning process helps you think and speak with confidence, and it's designed for long-term retention. With both a desktop option and a mobile app, you can take language learning on the go and practice whether you have 5 minutes or an hour. Plus, it's an incredible value with a lifetime membership to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Thank you to the sponsor of today's podcast, Warpath. The men of Second Company had their mission, but war is never predictable, and even the best-laid plans crumble under the chaos of battle. If you're the kind of person who thrives in that environment and loves tactical decision-making, then you need to check out Warpath, a strategy game that lets you immerse yourself in battles with realistic terrain, sound, and gorgeous visuals. With over 30 million downloads and a 4.6-star rating on iOS, Warpath lets you build the ultimate armory, customizing over 300 units with 1,000 unique modifications and allowing you to forge real-life weapons parts to upgrade your arsenal. But brute force alone won't win the war. Like the Colonel, you need strategy. Thanks to the Warpath's responsive RTS controls, you can use tactical positioning, air support, and flanking maneuvers to outwit your enemies in massive battles. You can employ creative solutions to take out your enemy by using sniper rifles, for instance. And the best part? You're never out of the fight. Rapid recruitment lets you reinforce your troops when they're in the field. And even if you're defeated, you keep all your resources. Experience an ever-shifting battlefield with army groups, artillery, flanking, air support, and more in this fun-filled war simulator game. So if you're ready to test your courage, tactics, and mettle against brilliant commanders from around the world, download Warpath today on PC or mobile by using my link in the description. So now we know where Orphism came from, and where it went. Let's talk about what the Orphics actually believed. Like I said, there's a lot of implied overlap with Pythagoras, and non-specific criticisms from outside authors that can be used to reconstruct more hypothetical beliefs, but I'm not going to deal with that today. partly because new Orphic texts are translated every few years that could change what I say, and partly because the few things we know with certainty are complicated enough as it is. Also, if you hear something in this section and think, hey, that sounds like this other religion, I can almost guarantee that someone, somewhere, probably a German PhD in the 1800s, has argued that connection before. The simple fact of the matter is, we just don't know, and I don't want to stop and tease out every possible influence and connection. Just the specific one that I am building towards for the final episode of this run, which is, to be very clear, just barely more credible than any of the others. That said, there are always exceptions when I make my own rules, and you'll probably be able to guess at least one of them as soon as I say it. Let's start at the end. What did the Orphics think about death? Well, they, the Pythagoreans, and even some Socratics, believed in metempsychosis. Typically, it's defined as the transmigration of the soul. I'm going to guess that those definitions mean roughly nothing to most people, but the general concept is probably better known as reincarnation. It's just that the word incarnate was coined in a Christian context and is typically used in a Hindu or Buddhist context today, so for whatever reason, people who deal with Greek stuff like to use Greek words. Regardless, different ideas of reincarnation were actually fairly common in Greece, probably all stemming from the same 5th and 6th century BC milieu of philosophy. Almost every school of thought from that time period that we have the right evidence for used a version of this same idea. And of course, because I point this out whenever I can, because I'm specifically that kind of nerd, you'll even notice this if you're deep into something like the Elder Scrolls fandom, or a lot of other fictional afterlives as well. In Orphism, the souls of living things were thought to be tiny, immortal fragments of the god Dionysus and the Titans, contractually bound to each other in successive life sentences. When the body died, Orphics believed that the soul descended into the underworld and drank from the river Lethe, one of the 5 rivers in the underworld that facilitate the passage from life to death. The Lethe was liquid forgetfulness, and would wipe the dead soul's memory of their past life before reincarnation. Some Orphics, like many other believers in reincarnation worldwide, believed the goal of life was to improve themselves before divine judgment, and worked toward a reincarnation when they would be considered pure enough to achieve arete, excellence. Think of it as a sort of Greek nirvana. Others buried their dead with tiny pieces of gold leaf inscribed with directions to navigate the afterlife and evade the Lethe altogether. One tablet from Thessaly specifically directs the deceased to find a secret spring in the underworld called the Pool of Mnemosyne. This was the goddess of memory, and her pool would, depending on how you interpret the tablet, either allow you to retain your memories in the next life and make it easier to break out of the cycle, or be the final step on your way to arete. Arete, in this case, meant spending eternity with Dionysus. Once again, exactly how that's described varies as much on modern interpretation as ancient ones. In some descriptions, it's simply that the soul becomes part of Dionysus's entourage, or that of another god, depending on the specific sect. In others, the soul literally becomes part of the god once again. To achieve arete, The Orphics believed that you had to be both morally upstanding and fully trained in the mysteries of their faith. So naturally, we know basically nothing about the latter. There were events described as Bacchic rites, in which wine was consumed not so much for pleasure as to become closer with their god. It's actually frequently compared to the Christian sacrament by early Christian authors. There were a number of other gods involved, including Dionysus' daughter Telete, who apparently played an important role in all of this, and many of these interconnected deities had statues depicting them with Dionysus or Orpheus in Dionysian temples. Non-Orphics in antiquity leaned hard into these bacchanals when trying to critique the Orphics, playing up Dionysus' patronage of drunken revelry, debauchery, and hedonistic violence. However, the Orphic texts themselves usually urge a very ascetic lifestyle. So it doesn't seem like this was purification via drunken orgy, unless modern scholars have dramatically misunderstood something. And I do have to admit, it would not be the first time that Victorian purity culture influenced classical studies for the long term. The lifestyle associated with these rites of purification was very similar to the sort of vegetarian pacifism practiced by Pythagoras, and fairly similar to some Indian religions. To be a moral person, an Orphic believer had to reject violence against all living things, or more accurately, animate things. Ancient Greeks generally didn't believe that plants were alive in the same way as humans or animals because they do not experience pain or move around, which was how they defined the soul, with one very weird exception. Both the Pythagoreans and some Orphics believed that beans had a soul. Nobody is entirely sure why. One possibility is that among all of the produce commonly available in the Mediterranean, beans have a sort of flesh and texture that they thought was too similar to meat. Another theory, and I swear this is genuine scholarly speculation, is that eating a lot of beans leads to farting, and they interpreted excessive gassiness as the body trying to expel the souls of beings and animals they had consumed. This stringent, life-preserving pacifism would have been one of the more obvious things that set devout Orphics apart from other Greeks in their day-to-day life. More mainstream Greek religion was awash in animal sacrifices. Small animals like birds were sacrificed for just about everything. Larger animals like goats or sheep came out for specific events or wealthy supplicants. Cattle were usually reserved for very important celebrations. The Orphics and others like them rejected animal sacrifice as a way to petition the gods, instead substituting wine offerings for blood in some rituals. Unlike many other reincarnation religions, including that of other Greeks, some Orphics did not just believe that living souls reincarnated after death as part of the natural order of things. No, they saw life on Earth itself as a form of punishment that had to be atoned for and escaped. Orphism, so far as I have ever read, was one of the first, if not the first religion, to believe in original sin. It's impossible to know whether this directly inspired the Christian idea of the same name, or might have been influenced by early Jewish thought around the concept. It is entirely possible that Paul the Apostle was at least vaguely familiar with the Orphic concept, and many influential Church fathers lived during the resurgence of the mystery cults in the Roman Empire. Justin Martyr, one of the first post-biblical writers to discuss the concept of original sin, even spent a little bit of time in a Pythagorean cult, which by that time was often interchangeable with the Orphics. However, the source of this sin is very different between the Orphics and most monotheistic religions. It is not a hereditary condition inherited for the misdeeds of past humans. In the Orphic view of the world, there's really no such thing as past humans. All the souls were created at once and just cycle in and out of circulation until they achieve arete. Instead, because human souls were first created in an act of terrible violence by the Titans, humanity is punished with a grueling cycle of life for the crimes of those ancient proto-deities. I promise that will make more sense next week. There is another Orphic ritual, specifically surrounding the funeral rites that we know of, but I am saving that for the next episode as well. I'll just tease it by saying I cannot believe it hasn't come up in my research for every single religion episode I've ever done. That ritual is described in the Derveni Papyrus, a now fragmentary Orphic commentary on one of the Orphic hymns composed in Macedon during the reign of Philip II, aka Alexander the Great's father. The Derveni Papyrus also just happens to be the oldest manuscript ever found in Europe. This document contains a commentary that leads nicely into the next episode. The author claims that the hymn is Orpheus's description of the Theogony, the birth of the gods and the universe, and attempts to explain the deeper meaning that the ancient bard hid within the song. In some cases, this makes a lot of sense, basically expanding on brief statements in each line of verse and explaining the language typical of Orphic hymns, which might have sounded strange to new initiates. It's written in short lines of poetry. You can't contain full detailed descriptions like that, so you get commentaries. In other cases, we get a fully ancient Greek display of something that has plagued religious thinkers since time immemorial. Is this fantastical claim from our religion allegory or literal? I can't think of a single religion that both has stories and mythos and does not grapple with that question. However, since the Derveni Papyrus is analyzing a version of the Theogony, one of the most famous myths of all, it provides an interesting alternative perspective. Typically, it seems that the Greeks thought of their gods as very literally having physical forms just like, or at least analogous to, the human body. The Derveni Orphics reinterpreted some of these stories to be more allegorical, and the author strongly implies that this is the best way to look at all of the hymns. It's not saying that the gods themselves are allegories for natural phenomenon, but it is suggesting that some of the physical descriptions of primordial spirits or mythical places are not meant literally. For example, the author stresses that Olympus, the home of the gods, is not literally a snow-capped mountain in the sky, but that those descriptions are meant to explain an idea beyond our worldly experience. Using the color scheme usually used to describe Olympus's visage, to go into a little bit of light ancient color theory and explain how it symbolizes the purity of the snow and the solidity of the stone. He also says that the sun is the penis of the sky, as in the primordial god Ouranos, and that mythical descriptions of castration are purely metaphor, which definitely was not a belief held by all mythologists. Others, like Hesiod, seem to mean it a lot more literally, and certainly many later writers interpreted it that way. However, I am starting to stray into part 3's territory, And I promise there will be so much more castration in that episode. Until next time. If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
At Ritual, Mother's Day is kind of a big deal, and we're celebrating accordingly. Find your ritual. If mom needs a bit of stress relief, digestive support, or is looking to support glowy, smooth skin, do it today with 40% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/podcast. That's ritual.com/podcast for 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.